So yesterday we had a lovely quiet day. Didn't have to listen to that bloke going on. That was quite nice. And then we ended up with that. What I found, I suspect I wasn't alone, very provocative ritual. And I've been not thinking about that. That wouldn't be the right way of putting it, but I've been it's been there in my awareness since pushing that poor little Peggy person head first down into the earth. And I was thinking about it alchemically, of course, this decapitation of the king is a precursor to his resurrection and conjunction with the queen. So this is a basic sort of a movement with, through these alchemical processes, is separation and then conjunction. Things are separated and then they're rejoined. So they're kind of let go of, but then actually they kind of come back, and they kind of come back in a transformed form or on a different level. And I think this is how we kind of have to understand our material, because in a sense it never goes. Yeah. In a sense, you know, whatever it is, if it's family material, if it's personal material, it might recede, it changes, your relationship with it softens or opens, or unfortunately, of course, in a lot of families, our relationship with material hardens, you know. I'm shocked, but I'm not shocked, because I've heard it so often, you know. I've talked to people who are, you know, I haven't talked to that family for 30 years, but it's still there, hasn't gone, you know. I just haven't, it's just sort of frozen, you know. And I suppose that's a bit of an analogy for a lot of stuff that happens when we don't address it. It's still there, but it's kind of frozen, it's just kind of... And at some point, usually, we've buried it, but we're going to, at some point, we have to dig it up again. You know, otherwise it just stays there, this sort of lump in your stomach or somewhere in your body. You find it somewhere in your body, don't you? A constriction in the throat, a sort of pain in the heart, a sort of brick in the guts, wherever it happens to be, a knot in the back, you know, or anywhere. You find it. When we start paying closer attention, becoming more intimate with our own bodies, which in and of itself seems a bizarre idea, because how can you not be intimate with your own body? But of course we can not be intimate with our own body, and very often we're not intimate with our own body. Half of it has gone numb, you know, because we haven't paid any attention. And of course we pay attention to it when it breaks down, don't we? Then we're forced to pay attention to it. But often up to that point, we might have quite an instrumental kind of mechanic. We want to keep it like a machine. We want to keep it working properly, but there's not really, perhaps for some of us, some of the time at least, there's not really much of a sense of intimacy and care and towards the body. Particularly as we get older, I think this is so important, that when the body does start breaking down, we have to develop a sense of care for the bits that are breaking down, you know, a sense of love. Yeah, a sense of love for the weakness, really, the wound that needs the love, you know. Anyway, I'm thinking about stories, I'm thinking about the material that keeps coming back, and I'm thinking about fairy stories and myths, and why these stories are repeated again and again, handed down from generation to generation, and yet when this is done properly, when this is done well, they stay very alive and very vital. So I'm thinking about these sort of mythological stories, particularly, and I'll say a little bit about the story of the Buddha in a minute, another image from the story of the Buddha's life, the myth of the Buddha's life. This isn't a historical account. We don't. And the Buddha didn't really have three palaces, and you know, it wasn't like that at all, really. If you go into the historical, social, what was going on in northern India at that time. But anyway, it's a myth. It's a myth. And because it's a myth, it has an archetypal resonance beyond itself, you know, beyond the historical. But anyway, I'm thinking about these stories, and I'm thinking about our stories. And I'm thinking about William Blake. William Blake has this, he talks about double vision. About double vision. What does he mean by this? He means that things can always be seen in different ways. And when we start to see something in one way, we've lost this connection with reality in a way, the poetic nature of reality. The way we're trying to work here, we could call it, sometimes we refer to it as soul, sometimes we refer to it as kind of mythic, archetypal. Most simply, we can just call it poetic. We're trying to work poetically with our own bodies, our own experience, our own material. To work poetically is to somehow open it up, not to come to some definitive understanding, but for that understanding to constantly open. In the opening, we want to put it in the body is a heart opening. Yeah, it's a feeling that we've grown a little bit bigger. When we have these stories, the only way these stories become mythic, archetypal, and therefore empowering when we open to them. And we see there's a double vision or a triple vision, or there's always multiple perspectives. Always multiple perspectives. And one doesn't necessarily invalidate another. The fact that I experience it like this and you experience it like that, they can exist together. Yeah, this is the poetic way. A good poem, people very often ask me, because I use a lot of poetry, you go to some people, they say, well, I didn't know what that meant. What does that mean? What did that mean? You know? And I think, I don't know. It never occurs to me, very rarely, occasionally, but very rarely. It never really occurs to me to ask what a poem means. This is to misunderstand poetry fundamentally. The question isn't what it means. The question is, what did that activate? What did I feel about that? That's the question. That's what a poem is there to activate your heart, activate you, not to give you an explanation. And the work we're doing here is the same thing, really. We're not trying to find an explanation. The problem is that people confuse... when the Buddha got enlightened, I'll bring it back to the Buddha. When we read accounts of the Buddha's enlightenment, insofar as it had a rational, intellectual aspect to it, it was his insight into conditionality. People very often confuse conditionality with causality. Conditionality is not causality. That's not to say there isn't such a thing as causality, but that was not what his insight was into. His insight was into conditionality. Conditionality means that everything that's ever happened to you in your life has brought you to sit here now. More than that, it means everything that's ever happened in the whole cosmos has brought you to sit here now. That's conditionality. Causality might be, well, I had a bit of time and I didn't know what to do, so I came on the trip. That's causality. Conditionality means that somehow the whole cosmos is concerned in some way or other with you sitting here now. From the Big Bang. This Big Bang, and now you're sitting here now. And it's all somehow interrelated. And of course, when we understand it like that, it's ungraspable, it's impossible. The only thing it can do for us is to open us. Yeah? It's the only thing. It's not an intellectual understanding. Oh, I understand conditionality, therefore I know what's going on. No, you've got no idea what's going on. It's all going on all the time. That's what's going on. Yeah. And somehow it's feeling comfortable with that. Somehow the enlightened experience is sort of understanding that and feeling comfortable with it, relaxing into it. This is it. This is how it is. Might not be how I want it, but it's how it is. So anyway, we've got the Buddha. We've already had, he's done this ascetic period in his life where he's tried to will himself to enlightenment. He tried to, the belief at the time, we still find it in a lot of religions really, we still find this idea that somehow spirit needs to be separated from body. Body is somehow gross. The material is somehow gross and keeps you tethered, keeps you, whatever, in the world in a way, and actually you want to be out of the world. And he spent his time doing these ascetic practices, years and years, hardcore ascetic practices, trying to liberate spirit from matter in a way. What we've been doing here is the opposite. We're trying to bring spirit down into matter, quite different. Radically different. Anyway, he does his ascetic practice, and in the end, he nearly kills himself, he nearly dies, blah, blah, blah. You all know this story, probably. And he then, at some point around this time, he has the rose apple experience. He remembers being something from his past. So, what he needed was already there. It'd been hidden in his coat, as it were, the jewel in the coat. It's been hidden in his memory. All those years of wandering around, all those years of ascetic practice. He remembers sitting under a tree, another tree. One day I'd love to do a retreat just on trees. There's so many trees in the Buddhist tradition, and not only the Buddhist tradition, but anyway. After reading, this is a slight diversion. Recently I read Robert Gray's The White Goddess, which is a very strange, mysterious book. But it more or less convinced me that actually I think Buddhism comes out of a tree cult, personally. I think its origins are probably a tree cult, but anyway, that's an aside. Anyway, another tree, and then of course the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. Gets this idea, I'm just going to sit under a tree. Well, I say just sit under a tree. We won't go into the significance of sitting under the tree, but it's such an... The archetypal significance of sitting under a tree can't really be exaggerated. It can't really... it's a complete cosmic... unification. It's this symbol of cosmic unification. He sits under this tree. And anyway, we all know the story. He has various experiences. He has his insights into his past life. He has an insight into conditionality. And at some point in this process, he has this psychic attack from Mara. All sorts of attacks, actually. Some of them are vicious daughters of Mars, right? Anyway, blah, blah. You know the story. Very familiar story. It's there in Jesus' life, isn't it? Goes into the desert, he's tempted by blah, blah. It's the dark night of the soul, if we want to give it that name. It's the negrito experience. It's the negrito experience. So I just want to mention briefly, what does he do about it? What does he do about it? What is the methodology that he employs? Because I think in the end, this is all we can do about it as well. When we're assailed by material that we can't do anything with, we can't actually, we would like to be able to let go of it, but it won't let go of us, it's just there. Oh, I let go of that, I let go of that, I let go of that. Of course, the more you want to let go of it, the more it wraps its tentacles around you. You know, it's like Grendel, isn't it, and Beowulf, you know, or like his mother, actually, but anyway, that's another story. So what does the Buddha do? We're told that he pervades Mara's host with the thought of love. That's it. That's it. That's all you can do, really. But that love isn't really just an idea. It might have a conceptual element. It's primarily expressed through the posture. And this is the point. This is what we can do in meditation, is that we can try and encourage the body to be open, the heart to be open, the body to be aligned, the body to be connected, and we can try and encourage a loving posture. This is basically what we're trying to do. And this is the creation of the vessel, the inner vessel, if you like, of the heart, the secret, the esoteric vessel of the heart, the alchemical heart. The fire of the alchemical heart is love. The other thing we do is just sit still as far as we can. Yeah. This is what we get. And of course the other famous is the when he gestures and touches the earth. So we invoke the earth to witness us. What are we doing when we're invoking the earth? In a way, we're doing what I started off by saying, we're invoking conditionality. We're saying that everything that's happened has come to this point. And the only thing I can do now is stand my ground. Yeah? Or sit on my Vajrasana, sit on my throne. Which means just to be fully present in your life. Even when it's shit, you're fully present in your life. That's all you can do. Well, of course we can do lots of other things. We can, you know, some of them good. Some of them bad, you know. We can get drunk, you know, have a spliff, you know, I don't know, whatever it is you do, you know, watch a box set, you know, eat a box of chocolate, you know, we can do loads of things. And all of them, they're not so bad, you know, we don't have to give ourselves such a terrible hard time about it. But now and then, when we are in touch with the lion, when we are in touch with the lion of the heart, this is an alchemical symbol, a green lion, alchemical symbol, very important alchemical symbol, this green lion. When we're in touch with our lion, when we're able to, we just sit with it. And we just open the heart to whatever degree we're able to do that. But I don't mean the sentimental heart, not the heart of children where their heads are too big for their bodies. You know what I mean? You know, these cartoons, not this sentimental heart, but the heart of the lion, the heart of courage, the heart of being fully in your life. And actually, the heart, the lion roars at the enraging desert. So this is a Wallace Stevens line, the poet Wallace Stevens. The lion, the mythology of the lion, one of the mythologies of the lion is that the lioness has such a mighty roar because her cubs are stillborn, and she has to roar to wake them up, to bring them to life. So that's something of a that's an aspect, many aspects, but that's one aspect of the lion of the heart. Its job is to roar, to bring those aspects of you alive that need to come alive. So this isn't a sentimental heart, this is the heart of the lion. And sometimes our heart of the lion is outrage. Yeah? It means strong emotion, strong. But it's also a love. Yeah? It's also the heart of love. And but not... Anyway, nothing. You know, so much one could say, but... basically, we've got courage and love to work with when we sit with difficult material. And it won't mean it isn't difficult. But maybe when we come on a retreat like this, at least we can support each other. There's nobody in this room. Doesn't find life difficult. Of course, sometimes we're quite, you know, things are going well, we're quite happy, everything's fine. Other times life is difficult. It's just how it is, you know. It's just how it is. And a lot of the time we play this weird dance, we do this weird dance with other people where we kind of make out everything's all right, maybe, you know. Or we minimise, or some people do the opposite dance, where their life is so terrible, you know, so tragic. Some people do that dance. We all got our little dance, you know, that we do. Some people, you know, butch it out. Anyway, we all got it. But when we sit together quietly like this, it's just an opportunity to acknowledge what it is to be a human being. We all know what it's like. Of course, we've all got our particular trials and triumphs. You know, we've all got our particularities. But actually, underneath those particularities, just the first noble truth, isn't it? Let's not forget the first noble truth. It takes a long time for most of us to really understand what's meant by the first noble truth. Most of us get involved in Buddhism because we want to avoid suffering. But that isn't what the first noble truth says. It doesn't say avoid suffering. It says life is suffering. And for a lot of us, even after we've been Buddhist for some years, even decades, we're still desperately trying to avoid suffering. We still haven't got it. We still haven't got it. It takes a long time just to get that first noble truth. When we get the first noble truth fully, the rest kind of, I don't think it's easy, but we can start working with the rest of it. We start working with trying to find some way of being with suffering that's more comfortable, more compassionate, more connected, more supportive, more delightful, more joyful. But we can't really do that until we've got it. You know? So when you sit here and you suffer, what you need to do is just open to it, because that's the first noble truth. And it's, as I say, it's probably the most difficult part of the whole path is really understanding that on a deep level. Things are as they are. Doesn't mean they don't change. Three lakshanas, these three marks are not optional. Yeah, they're not optional. Whatever it might seem like. Anyway, okay. So we're just, what we're going to do now, break our little habit. Let's have a lay down. We'll start with a lay down. And just laying down together, hang on a minute, don't have to do anything yet. Just laying down together is something, have a sense of doing it with other people, yeah, and it's some act of intimacy, or some act of solidarity, oddly enough, I think. It's something evocative of when we used to be a tribe, yeah? We used to lay down together in a cave, in a long hut, and find some solace, find some sense of security and companionship and love, and just laying down. So we'll do that this morning to start with. Yeah. So you can move into that when you're ready.